Let's take our Bibles. We'll go to Genesis. We're in chapter 23 today. We're nearly halfway done with this book. It's been less than a year. Here's where we are. Genesis chapter 23. We're going to be just looking at one chapter. We're going to start actually back in chapter 22, beginning in verse 20. A couple verses just kind of tucked in the middle. We just finished with the large narrative of an extremely moving passage where Abraham sacrifices his son Isaac, and God interjects just in time and provides the lamb that takes the place of his son. And God says, "Now I know that you love me more than anything, that I am God in your life." Genesis chapter 22, beginning in verse 20, we'll read down through all of 23. "Now after these things it was told to Abraham, 'Behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz, his firstborn, Buz, his brother, Kemuel, the father of Aram, Chesed, Hatzo, Pildash, Jidlaf, and Bethuel. Bethuel fathered Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abram's brother. Moreover, his concubine, whose name was Reuma, bore Teba, Gaham, Tehash, and Maacah. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham rose up from before his dead and said to the Hittites, 'I am a sojourner and foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight.' The Hittites answered Abraham, 'Hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead.' Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land, and he said to them, 'If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and entreat for me Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It's at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place.' Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, of all who went in at the gate of his city, 'No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead.' And Abraham bowed down before the people of the land. And he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, 'But if you will, hear me. I give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there.' Ephron answered Abraham, 'My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead.' Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field, throughout its whole area, was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites, before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah his wife in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as a property for a burying place by the Hittites.'" Well, even when it's delayed in its coming, death is an intruder. It remains an intruder. In this chapter, we have a focus on death. The word bury in this context is used some 11 times. That's the focus. 9 times it refers to death or dying, and 7 times the specific phrase, "bury my dead" or "burying my dead," is used over and over again in this passage. It's the most concentrated focus we have on death since chapter 5, when we're given a genealogy and each one says, "and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died." Death, when we look at the story of God, is an intruder. And even when it comes late in life, it's something that has been anticipated, but something that doesn't quite fit by design. We've just lost Pastor Garber. Not lost, we know where he is. But We've just had to say goodbye to Pastor Garber because of the reality of death. And as you would talk with Pastor Garber, he would say frequently, you know, I don't want to be here anymore. I'm ready to go. In fact, last week, Harriet was talking to him. She said, I'm going down to the shore. I'll be back next week. And kiddingly, he said, I may not be here when you get back. Okay. He's been looking for it for a while. We've been looking for it for a while. But when you get that call on Friday afternoon and you hear, if you want to see him one last time, you'd better get down here today. It's something that grabs a hold of you. It grabs you by the throat and it looks you square in the face. And you have to deal with that which you know is real. You know it fits to some degree, but it just doesn't fit. Death is that way. But there's something about the death of believers that the world can't explain. There's a joy, there's a hope, there's a peace. And as we were there in that hospital, it was interesting as the families all gathered around, there's laughing, there's giggling. In fact, the nurses had to come and say, it's time for the other patients to go to sleep. Please go down the hall. Okay, you can carry on your conversations down there. There's something that when the believer is ready to enter eternity, yes, it's with gravity. Yes, it's with sobriety. But there's also an anticipation. And each one of us, as we sat around that bed looking at a dying man, we're deep down in our own hearts longing that maybe that could be me. One day it will be me. And sometime it's going to be my turn to pass through this door onto the other side, where I too will be with Christ, where I won't get worn out singing the songs of heaven. This comes because believers have a special relationship to the promises of God. In fact, a believer is a believer in the promises. That's what makes us a believer. Those promises then lie beyond the grave. That's what makes us a believer. And as things come into our life, things that look like losses, they would threaten to rock us off balance. They would threaten to drive us to our knees. They would threaten to cause us to stumble. And death is only one of those losses that life brings to us. But in the midst of life's losses, we find that faith embraces the loss. Faith is able to embrace the loss. And that, as we come to the story of Abraham burying his wife, we get to see in a very unique way a genuine demonstration of absolute faith. I think as we come to the text this morning, this passage provides us kind of a two-pronged strategy for embracing life's deep losses by faith. The first of these strategies is for faith to allow life's losses to clarify the tension of our mortality, the tension of our transience, the fact that we're here for just a little while, the fact that we don't have a permanence in this life. When we come to those things in life that bring us deep loss, faith allows those losses to clarify the tension that we find ourselves in. As we start out the passage, back in verse 20 of chapter 22, we're given the list of names. Milcah, we've just seen in chapter 21 that Sarah became pregnant after several years of being barren. She gives birth to Isaac. God requires Isaac as a sacrifice, and God spares the life of Isaac in chapter 22. We come to the end of that passage, and we see that Sarah isn't the only one that has produced life. God has been working with others back in the home country, if you will. Abraham and Sarah, they've been by themselves. They've had a barren experience, and finally God has provided fruit in their life, the fruit of the womb. They don't have any land at this point, but they have watering hole rights. And so slowly they're getting just a little bit of a foothold in the promised land. And all of a sudden the camera pans back to the home country, if you will. And it says, back there, lots of things are happening, lots of children are being brought forth. And this is what's going on back home, if you will. And then we're given this narrative of Sarah. I think as we look at this, and the Bible sets it up, it sets it up this way because it reminds us that we're not defined by our past positions. We're not defined by our past places of residency. For Abraham, home used to look like Ur of the Chaldees. It used to look like Padan Aram, where all of his kinfolk are, where they're flourishing. That used to be home, if you will. Be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. You watch the Wizard of Oz, and Dorothy has those ruby slippers, and she knocks them together, and she says, there's no place like home, there's no place like home, and finally she ends up at home. As Abraham is in Canaan, he has the opportunity, watching all that God is doing, or maybe at times watching all that God isn't doing. Because God said he was going to do something, and then nothing happens, and nothing happens for a very long time. And now he comes to this juncture in his life where Sarah is taken away from his side. The promises that they've chased together still have very little fulfillment. The children, which would be as the sands of the seashore and the stars in the sky, number all of one. The land, the whole land through which he was to walk, he doesn't own so much as he could put his sole of his foot on, the book of Acts says. None of it belongs to him. What does he have? A hole with water at the bottom. That's it. In fact, he doesn't own it. He just gets rights to drink from it. That's all that he has. And as he comes to this point in life, when God reaches in and does what God allows, he allows death to rip that person from our side. What's Abraham to think? What do I have to live for here? Maybe I should just turn my sights back to... But he doesn't do it. That is the faith of this chapter. That's the tension of this chapter. Because Abraham spends a lot of money on a small parcel of land, and it's only for a grave. It's not for him to live on. It's not for him to plow. It's not for him to graze his sheep or his cattle or his camels. It's a place where he can lay his dead. That's the only parcel of land that he has. But in buying this parcel of land, he says, you know what? All that used to define me no longer defines me. My past positions, the places that I used to belong to, they don't belong to me anymore. In fact, I don't belong to them. For some of us, it's hard. We've never moved away from any place. But if you have, you know that as you come to a new place, it takes quite a while to get acclimated. For the first 3 years of my life out here in Pennsylvania, I could not bring myself to say the word soda. It's not that I didn't know how. It's just whenever I thought of fizzy stuff that you drink, I always said pop. And every time I said pop, the teens would always laugh at me. And for heaven's sakes, I still cannot say the word root without chewing on it like it's a garbled marshmallow in my mouth. It's root, okay? And the things on our houses are roofs. They're not roofs. And I don't do that because I'm trying to be obstinate and stubborn. It's just, I'm not from here. But Abraham had to make a choice. He said, I'm not from here. That's where I belong. But you know what? On purpose, don't belong there any longer. That no longer defines me. This is where I belong. And as we come to this juncture in Abraham's life, he's forced with a choice that reminds him of his transience. The fact that he doesn't fit there, and reality is, he doesn't even really fit right here. Not yet. And that's what God does for us in putting his finger on something in our lives from time to time and taking it away. And in our desperation, we look up to God and we say, God, how could you? It hurt so bad. I loved it so much. It defined who I was. And God says, that was the problem. I'm the one who gets to define you. Our relationship is what defines you. Not your previous positions, not the places that you've been at. We see that as the story then unfolds for us in chapter 23, that we're not defined by our current blessings or our set of circumstances. Sarah, it says there in verse 1, she lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah, what does her name mean? Do you remember? Sarai means my princess. God says no, she's the princess. The princess of many nations. Sarah, who Abraham marries and brings her into the promised land and comes up with a grand strategy. Says, Sarah, you are so beautiful. He should have just stopped there. Okay. He says, you're so beautiful, everybody's going to want you. So here's what you do. You tell them you're my sister. Sarah is stunningly beautiful because around the age of 65, when the famine is in the land, they go down into Egypt and Pharaoh wants her to be a part of his harem at the age of 65. Later on, when she's 90 years old, she's back in the promised land and Abimelech says, I want that lady to be mine. Sarah was a stunningly beautiful lady who retained her vivaciousness, her liveliness, and God blessed her. But we come to this point and it says 127 years old and she dies. You know, when we're young, we think we're invincible. When we're 18, 19, 20, 30, you lose all that when you hit 40, okay? But when we're young, we think, nothing's going to happen. I can always run faster than my dad, okay? And so far, I probably still could. But there's coming a day when I'll have that walker. And there's already the day that my kids can run faster than me. It wouldn't be so bad, but it's Kaylee that can run faster than me. Right? So but we think as we're growing up that there's nothing ever going to stop me. But God says for Sarah, these are the years of Sarah's life. We were around the bed yesterday at Pastor Garber's looking at Psalm 139. And it says, God, before any of my members were ever formed in the womb of my mother, in the belly of my mother. In fact, before there were any of my days ever on planet Earth, you had recorded them before they ever began. And as we came to yesterday, June 21st, the first day of summer, 2014, God's days for Pastor Garber were done. They had been numbered before the foundation of the world, and he came to the end, and they're done. My friend, you have a certain number of days. You may think, oh, I've got lots of time. I've got lots of energy. I'm smart. I'm a careful driver. I get good grades. Nothing's going to happen to me, at least not for a long time. And those who are further down the road and look back in the rearview mirror at all of that their life has covered, say, you know what? It goes faster than you know. And one day, it will be written of you. And they lived so many years, and they died. But the thing is, we're not defined by our current blessings. We're not defined by our current set of circumstances. We're not defined by those with whom we do life. Because we come to that second verse here, and Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And who's left? Abraham. Several of you have had the opportunity that you haven't asked for, but you've had the opportunity to say goodbye to the one that you've been yoked with in this life, the one that you've become one flesh, one body, one mind, one spirit. You've shared life together. You've said goodbye. It's a hard thing and I can't anticipate it. I can't understand it. But when we come to this point and we see how death rips into this relationship and it interjects itself in an unwelcome way, God puts his finger on something in the life of Abraham, something that he treasured so much, he called her my princess. God takes it away and God says, Abraham, your life is not defined by anybody else. It's not even defined by the one that you've done life with. Sarah was the one who, along with Abraham, had to say goodbye to Ur of the Chaldees, along with the gods of her fathers. She was the one who had to come to this promised land, and where things were so bad that they went down into the land of Egypt because there was nothing for them to eat. Sarah was the one who had to learn with Abraham what it was to walk by faith. She learned the danger of doubt as she herself comes up with the plan to save face for God and provide a son for Abraham. And Hagar is interjected into the equation. Sarah had witnessed the power of God at work for her and against her enemies as she watches Abraham go off to rescue Lot. And she sees Laomer defeated. And as he's coming back, there Melchizedek comes out and blesses him, where the king of Sodom offers to Abraham, and Abraham in his integrity says, "No, I will receive nothing from your hand, only the blessing of God." She watches as Lot chooses the very best and strips it away from Abraham when everything belonged to him. She watches later as the five cities of that valley are destroyed in fire and brimstone. She watches Hagar, who has the son that she cannot have and runs away at her own beating and is forced back by God. And God says, "I see, I know, I hear, I care." And that's my message through this Egyptian girl to you, Sarah, to you, Abraham. I see, I know, I care. She watched as they were sent away again, knowing that that tension exists between the son of the slave woman and the son of the free woman, and only the son of promise could receive and inherit the blessings. She had watched all of these things when God worked in a stunning way and provided Isaac. Sarah learned along with Abraham what it was to walk by faith. And now, Sarah's gone. And sometimes when people are in your life and God takes them from your life. I remember when a youth pastor was resigned when I was growing up. I was from sixth grade going into seventh grade. I had been looking forward to being with this youth pastor for many years. And he just had a great rapport with the teens. There was the security of being in a church that was stable. And just as I was coming to the summer of my seventh grade year, this man resigns. And I felt like I'd just lost something, like that security that I was looking for, that next step I needed to take in life spiritually was all of a sudden gone. God had to say, "You know what? It's not about people. It's not about the man. It's about me. It's about me." Your life isn't defined by others, even others that you have closely done life with for many, many years. And now all of a sudden Abraham's left, and he has to mourn and to weep alone. This is a sad story. It rips your heart out as it just gets going. We find finally that we aren't defined by our past positions, places, properties. We're not defined by our current blessings or set of circumstances. We're not defined by those with whom we do life. We are defined solely by our relationship with God, and then only through His promises. Remember what the Bible said back in chapter 15, verse 6? God gave the promise to Abraham, and Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. God had reached into the life of Abraham, and Abraham believed the God who had given his word. And when Abraham believed, God says, "That's what I was looking for. Your heart is right before me." Did it matter how many sacrifices he made? The one that mattered most was the thing that he valued most, and he passed that test. And God said, "I know that you fear me, that I am the greatest reality in your life, Abraham. That's what defines you. That's what defines me." And this loss provided yet another opportunity to demonstrate that relationship. We don't think that way. That's why on Sunday mornings during Sunday school, we're going through this book, How People Change, because we have the rather arrogant idea that what I have belongs to me. whether it's comfort, whether it's possessions, whether it's relationships. And when anything takes those things from me, I have somehow been violated. I've somehow been stripped of something that belongs to me. And God's just trying to do a work in our lives and trying to reveal to us that He is our portion, that He is all we need, that He's our rock. And as He puts His finger on that in our lives, it becomes an opportunity for us to exercise real faith. And so often we don't pass the test. And so He's got to put His finger on something else in our life. And finally, He helps us to understand, my child, my grace is sufficient for you. And so as we look at the life of Abraham, we come down to verse 3. Abraham rises up from before his dead. He says to the Hittites, I am a sojourner. I'm a foreigner among you. He recognizes he doesn't fit. He uses two different words. One means that I'm not from here, therefore I never belong here. The other has the idea of I'm presently in this area, but it's only for a little while. And he means only for this life. Though I've been here for several years, I'm going to be here till I die. It's just a temporary time that I get to be with you because I don't belong here. I'm not from here. He uses these two words and says, you know what? As far as you guys are concerned, I'm a sojourner. I'm a foreigner. And there's several different times he comes down through this text. He says, Abraham stands in contradistinction to the people of the land. Verse 7, look at verse 7. Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land. Same phrase is used down in verse 12. Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, there's the people of the land, and there's Abraham, the owner of the land. But the owner of the land doesn't fit with the people of the land because his inheritance lies beyond the grave. And so as we look today, God gives us a two-pronged strategy for embracing life's losses, and faith allows life losses to clarify the tension that simply exists in the fact that I am a citizen of earth while being a citizen of heaven. And God puts His finger on things in my life to take them away, to draw my heart closer to my inheritance that belongs on the other side. The second thing that God does in these losses is that faith allows life's losses to clarify the substance of my faith. As God, one by one, puts His finger on those things in my life and takes them away from me, it's not because He hates me, it's because He loves me. And He's drawing me into a deeper dependence on Him, a deeper satisfaction in Him. And as faith embraces that loss, it reveals not only the fact that I don't belong here, but it also reveals the substance of the things that I'm hoping for. It gives evidence of the things that nobody else can see, but God is revealing from my heart. Our faith is in God's promises. These promises that are initiated, but they're as yet unfulfilled. We come to verse 4. Abraham says, I'm a sojourner and a foreigner among you. Give to me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. It's an interesting word there in the Hebrew. It's the word achazah. It has the idea of being a possession, but a possession that you don't enter into the transaction as an equal. You enter into the transaction only as a recipient. It has the idea of being a possession that you inherit, that you get from somebody else. It's the word that God uses actually back in chapter 17, verse 8, when He says, I will give you a possession in this land. I will give you an inheritance. I will give you something that you couldn't earn, that you couldn't buy, but it will belong to you nonetheless because it's mine to give. Abraham uses this term in trying to strike a bargain with the Hittites. In verse 4, he says, give me a property. Give me an inheritance. And as they look at the circumstances there, they're probably thinking nothing other than he needs a piece of property that he can bury his dead. And once it belongs to him, then that plot of land becomes the family grave. And that's how graves were used back then. You would use it not just for one person, but oftentimes they would stick that body in the grave. The body would decompose, and they would take the bones and they would put them in a box, and they would move it to the back of a cave, and then they would put the next body in there. And so there would be several different boxes of bones that had the flesh had decayed off of, and that cave would be able to house several bodies. We just don't think through that process. We don't do that anymore. But that tomb then would belong to Abraham as an inheritance, so that when his body would die, and the body of his son, and the body of his grandson, they would be able to use that same piece of property for the same purpose. This is an unthreatening proposition that Abraham brings at this point. But he uses the term, he says, I'm looking for an inheritance. It means two things to two different people. To them, it's just a graveyard that he can pass on to his kids. But Abraham says, I'm looking for what God promised me. I'm looking for something that I can't buy, but God is ready to give. He uses the term down in verse 9 once again. Give me the cave of Machpelah that Ephron owns. It's at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as an inheritance. Now, wait a minute. He's going to buy this inheritance? The Bible sets up this tension in a unique way. But at the end of verse 20, it says that this field, this cave, was made over to Abraham as an inheritance, as a possession. Right there, the burying place among the Hittites. It was given by the Hittites. Abraham is looking for something very particular. He's looking for the promises of God to be initiated. Right now, all the land he owns is a hole in the ground with water at the bottom of it. Okay? There's no land per se that he owns. But this would be the beginning of everything that is his and rightfully belongs to him. He has not an interest in the choicest of their tombs. Look verse 5. They said, the Hittites answered him, hear us, my lord, you're a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of, what's that next word? In the choicest of our tombs. Okay, there's not a man among us who wouldn't allow you to bury her in his tomb. Abraham says, there's a problem here. I'm not so concerned about the condition of the tomb. The choicest, the dumpiest, the best, the worst. That's not what I'm primarily concerned with. I'm concerned with the preposition that goes in front of the word tomb. His tomb, your tomb, our tomb. I want it to be mine. This has to belong to me. This is what I'm looking for. Not because I'm some egotistical maniac. I want this because this is what God has promised me. And my hope is in the promise. That's what defines me. And as Abraham suffers a severe loss in his wife, as his wife is ripped from his side, what it reveals in his heart is that his heart is anchored to the promises of God. What a stark way for God to put his finger on that in his life, which becomes the anchor of his soul. And as we move forward, we see that Abraham receives in this text this parcel of land. But it's just a down payment. It's just the beginning. It's real, but it's only a portion. We're given this same idea when we come to the book of Ephesians chapter 1, and God is laying out all of the variegated blessings that belong to us in Jesus Christ. He says, every blessing in the heavenlies belongs to you. But you know what you get to experience now? One thing. The earnest or the down payment of the Holy Spirit. But because you have the down payment, it means that everything that belongs to you will follow. And as Abraham gets this real but tiny piece of property, that he has to pay for. It's not given. He receives the down payment of the promises of God. This promise, Calvin says, was not extinguished either by his own death or by that of his family, but rather in death the promise began to flourish. We see that while they themselves, Abraham and Sarah, were silent and speechless, the sepulcher cried aloud. The death formed no obstacle to their entering into possession of God's promise. And that's the way it is. As believers of God, not even death can wrestle away from us our inheritance, and we have the down payment of our inheritance today. God has sealed us with his Holy Spirit. We see that our faith is in God's promises that are initiated, though as yet unfulfilled. We see that our faith then is in God's ways that are perfect, but generally less direct than what we would desire. In verse 5, it says he could have his choice of any tomb as a gift. We come down and he names a specific plot of property. Ephron's cave, Machpelah. Machpelah means the double cave. And it's in a certain field. It's east of Mamre. And he names a specific cave. That's the one that he wants. He could have received his choice of any tomb as a gift. He says a specific tomb. Look at verse 11. Ephron says, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field. I give you the cave. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you." He can have this cave that he chose out of all the tombs as a gift. But what does he say? "No, I don't want it as a gift from you." It's the same thing that we come to here as we came to back in chapter 14. The king of Sodom is rescued by Abraham. They get to that place where Melchizedek is blessing Abraham. And the king of Sodom wants to get in on the action. He says, "Abraham, why don't you take everything but the people? You can have them. Thank you so much." Abraham says, "I won't take so much as a shoelace from you, because I don't want you to have the privilege of saying that you have benefited me. I don't want to be dependent on you. I don't want you to get bragging rights in my life." I wonder if I am that dedicated. I just want the blessings. I just want the benefits. Do I have the integrity of wanting my life to have only the signature of God on it? You know what? God's ways are constructed so only he gets the glory. But wherever God's will is stated, there's always the temptation to obtain that will by a lesser way than his own. Think in the life of Abraham and Sarah. Abraham, you will have a son. Not coming. Okay, so where's this son? Well, Abraham maybe should help God out. He said it's yours. So that he's not coming through in a very timely manner. Let's help God out. Result is Ishmael. Whenever God states his will, there's always the temptation to have it in a way other than the way God designs it. Think of Jesus Christ, the one who will inherit all of the earth and will rule the nations with a rod of iron. Jesus Christ owns everything. The Messiah, the Anointed One, the King. As he's out in the wilderness, no bread, he has the opportunity to glorify himself in the last temptation. "Jesus, this can all be yours without a cross." Jesus says, "No, I will not be benefited in my life by anything that bears the signature of anyone but God." Folks, it's not the end that's ultimately important, though that's important. God getting us there by the right route. In fact, God says, people will jump over the fence to get on this way. They can't get on this way but through the gate. And Pilgrim's Progress spends many chapters talking about this narrow way that few get in by the right door. Jesus says, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. You can only get to the end by going the proper way. Abraham understood that. You won't give this to me. It must be God who gives it to me. So on a physical level, Abraham has to pay for this. And we come down to verse 18. It says that the field of Ephron was made over as a property to Abraham. There it uses a different term than that inheritance, that achazah. It's the word mikna. It has the idea of being a transaction. He gave him money. He gave him the land. It was a fair deal. It wasn't so fair. Okay. But it was a rather costly trade. But when God puts his finger on things in our lives, it reveals what we have faith in. Our faith is in God's promises. Our faith is in God's way. Finally, our faith is in God's dividends. The end. The thing that we wanted at the end. The end goal. Our faith is in what God will do for us at the end of this end of the story. It's incomparable, but it's apparently costly. At least costly in this life. Great deal detail is given as we go through this text from verse 10 on down through verse 18 to underscore the legitimacy and the permanency of this transaction. There's the parties involved. Abraham calls out a certain man and says, it's going to be between me and this man in particular. The purchase price is haggled over, but not for very long. The full price, I will give him the full price, Abraham says in verse 9. And Ephron says in verse 11, no, I give it to him. Abraham says, no, I will give you the price of the field. Verse 15, Ephron says, well, if you insist, the price is 400 shekels, which is a rather high price, a very high price. And what would happen in the dealings of the day in the Orient there, you would start out high, and it was expected that you would get chewed down to a lesser price. And then you would throw back another price, and he'd give you a lower price, and finally you'd end up somewhere in the middle. Abraham doesn't even get into the haggling process. So this exorbitant price is thrown out there, and Abraham says, sold. Here's my number. I'll take it. I'll cash in. So the purchase price is agreed on. There's a proper standard in verse 16. It says, he paid in today's rate, the rate of the merchants of the day. The property description is given to us in verse 17. It's Machpelah, the double cave. It's in a field east of Mamre. It's the field with a cave with all the trees that are in that field in that whole area. It's a specific place. And it's recorded. It's done in front of numerous witnesses over several different times in this passage. It's in front of the Hittites, in their presence, in the hearing of the Hittites, in the hearing of all who went in at the gate, the hearing and the sight of the sons of my people, in the hearing of the people of the land. Over and over again, this text says, this is a legitimate transaction because several people have witnessed it. And as several people witnessed the transaction, several people got to witness the faith of a man who would not be benefited by anybody but God. Consequently, at the end, it's made over to Abraham as a possession, a purchased possession, and it was for the sole purpose of awaiting in death what he had not obtained in life. Abraham said, I want my heart and soul to be anchored here because this is what God promised to give me. Yes, it was costly, but it was worth every cent because it's the down payment of what everything else that God is going to give me. Ian DeGeed says, the high price that was extracted from him behind a cloak of polite bargaining, he considered worthwhile. Though Ephron the Hittite required him to buy the entire field, not just the cave he'd initially requested, and he named an almost extortionate price, Abraham paid up without demur. But which of them got the better part of the deal? Ephron walked away with a pocket full of silver that he couldn't take with him when he died. Abraham obtained in symbolic form an inheritance that he could never lose. Eternal life in God's presence is not cheap. For some, it may even cost their life, even their very life itself. Nonetheless, it's worth whatever it costs. I'm going to be a little transparent as I close this morning. I was getting dressed this morning, and my foot got caught in my pants. And all of a sudden, I tripped. And I'm going down, stumbling down, and I would have flopped on my face on the floor if I hadn't been a bed there. And I reached out and I steadied myself. My loving wife was watching. She started laughing at me. I don't know if you can imagine that, but she laughed at me. And I said, "What's the matter? Have you never fallen over as you're putting your pants on before?" And with a wry smile, she says, "If I had, I wouldn't tell you." In life, oftentimes it's the simple little things. It's the mundane things. It's the stupid things that trip us up. Sometimes it's the really big things that would cause us to fall flat on our face. But here's the message today, folks. Faith enables you to embrace whatever Satan would use to trip you up as an opportunity to remember that this world is not my home, I'm just passing through. And to give you an opportunity to evidence what is it that your heart is anchored to. The promises of God or the things of this world. We rest in a God who's alive and real and working on our behalf.